This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. One of the thorniest issues before state lawmakers as they conclude the 2019 legislative session is a deal on taxing short-term rentals. HPR's Ryan Finnerty joins us this morning with an update.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what's the latest?
So there was one major bill concerning short-term rentals that was being considered by lawmakers this year. It might sound familiar to anyone who's been following this issue. It had two major provisions. The first and the main one was that it would require the booking platforms like Airbnb or VRBO to collect state taxes, general excise, and transient accommodation taxes. And the second that got a little bit less attention but was pretty important would have required those booking platforms to submit monthly reports to the state or the counties on how many rentals were being posted and actually purchased in each zip code throughout the state. And we'll get back to that in a minute, but that created a lot of sticking points for both sides of the issue. This was kind of similar to a bill that passed the legislature in 2016, but was vetoed by Governor David Ige. I'm sure you remember that. And at the time, he had said his intent was for them to tweak some of the language and pass it again next year. And obviously that never happened. So this bill got the closest of anything since then. And it came down to the Senate. It had passed the House and it failed on Friday in a 12-12 tie vote with one senator, Republican Kurt Favela from Eva Beach, absent. And he had expressed his opposition to the bill. Not entirely clear why he was absent. So at this point, the bill is dead. However, there is a possibility that it could be brought back. There is a rule 66 in the Senate for all the Star Wars fans out there that allows the side that prevailed in a vote to bring an issue back. So in this case, it would be the senators who voted against the bill. If one of them decides to introduce a motion to reconsider, this bill could come back. It would have to be on Thursday, which is the final day of the legislature. And one of the interesting things about it, Catherine, was that advocates on both sides of the issue opposed it. Both pro-short-term rental and anti-short-term rental advocates didn't like it. And they didn't like it for different reasons. But first, we'll hear from Philip Minardi, who is the Director of Policy Communications for Expedia Group. That's the company that owns HomeAway and VRBO. And here he is explaining why they opposed the bill.
As a platform, we are open to offering cities information in the aggregate, so giving them information about the activity that's happening from a holistic perspective. When it gets down to handing over personally identifiable information on our customers, that is something that we take incredibly serious and something that, at the end of the day, our travelers and the broader public have voiced concerns about as well. I think the message we've given to state legislators, the message we've given to city and county officials, is that we're willing to collaborate on things that help drive enforcement, that help get registration numbers up higher than they currently are. But at the end of the day, we can't infringe upon the personal and private data of our customers.
And so that was Philip Minardi from Expedia Group explaining their opposition to Senate Bill 1292. And you heard it was related to data privacy, customer privacy. We should say that the bill would have allowed these reports to be anonymous. They weren't going to list specific names or properties, but they would have had to provide by zip code information, and Expedia said that was a bridge too far for them. The bill also generated opposition from anti-short-term rental advocates here locally, and they felt that this was the legislature giving tacit approval to what is often an illegal activity. Many of these rentals, as you know, are not permitted. So here's Tyler Dos Santos Tam from the community group High Good Neighbor.
If what's reported on the transient accommodations tax, the TAT, doesn't match up with the income that's being reported on the GET side, that's a big red flag. But that, again, that only works if those two departments are talking to one another. And so that's why we need the enforcement structure to come first. For the neighbors that we represent, you know, they want to know what's going on. They want to know who they can complain to rather than calling 911 when the tourists staying next door to you are noisy. Can we know who the landlord is? Can we know that it's an actual person, not an LLC, not some voicemail box that you're going to get when you call to complain? And these are the things that I think are important and are kind of lost in this discussion when we only focus on, can the state get some money out of this? Or on the county side, what the zoning rules are going to be. These have real impacts on the neighbors, and you know, we need to consider those.
So as of right now, Catherine, that bill has failed, but we don't know. It could come back Thursday, and we likely won't know until the last minute whether or not that's going to happen. Tomorrow is a recess day, so there won't be any votes. Thursday is the final day of the legislature, and that's when something would happen if that bill were to come back.
Right, and I know our partners at Civil Beat are reporting that Senator Donovan de la Cruz has some concerns, and there's some last-minute maneuvering, and he might be horse-trading. That he wants that bill to get out.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that he would have to compel someone who voted against the bill to introduce a measure to bring it back up because, as we mentioned earlier, the Rule 66 in the Senate says the prevailing side of any vote has to be the one to bring it back up. So if that happens, we will see. We'll have to wait until Thursday. But yesterday there was action at the local level. The Honolulu City Council heard two proposals, well, several different versions of these two main proposals that would represent a pretty sweeping change in how vacation rentals are regulated on Oahu specifically. They're very thick bills. There's been a lot of changes to the originals, a lot of different provisions that are still somewhat in flux. One of the most notable ones is that rentals in outside of the resort areas, which are like Waikiki and Ko'olina, would be capped at, right now it's at half of 1% of the total housing stock of that area. There was debate between 1% and half of 1%. And that would represent a very significant decrease in what's currently out there. Here's the city's director of planning and permitting, Kathy Sokugawa, talking about that cap.
At 1% of total, which means every development plan area would have a different maximum because every development plan has different population figures. And so my remembrance was, I think it was like 27 units in the North Shore at 1%. You know, so if you want to go with one half, you know, it's less than a dozen probably.
And Sokugawa, a little bit later, walked that back and said it would actually be 70, not 27. There, she got some information from one of the staffers. But still, 70 units under this plan, 70 units on the North Shore, that's all of the North Shore Planning District, that would, the short-term rentals would be reduced to just 70. And some of those would be hosted. In most areas, it would only be hosted rentals that are allowed, so not a whole home or a whole apartment, but rooms within one of those properties. A little more flexibility in the resort areas and some of the higher density areas in the urban core where whole home rentals are allowed and more of them are allowed. There's other restrictions too about being within a certain distance of other rentals, the number of rooms within a house that can be rented, that kind of thing. This one, we don't know exactly when this is going to come up. That was the sort of the final revision was yesterday council members made. They have two final proposals now that will need to go before the full city council before either a vote up or down. That could be as soon as May 8th, which is the next meeting of the full council, but we don't know if it will be on the agenda or not.
Right, and I know there's a big question about which way Tommy Waters might vote on this because I think Trevor Ozawa has until this week, Friday, to determine if he's going to try and challenge the election results. And I know the city clerk's office says maybe the soonest Waters would be sworn in could be maybe possibly Monday, and then this would be his big vote. But we'll have to see if it gets postponed or if he votes that day.
Right, and we should say he was endorsed by some unions, which are against this, against short-term rentals. So, but we don't know which way he'll go and if he'll get to vote at all.
All right, thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it. And you can find all of our coverage of the various short-term rental proposals at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
When
In today's musical backyard, an enviable career that brought the sounds of the ukulele to a wide audience over 9 decades. Along the way, our Hawaii-born artists collaborated with some of the giants of American music, Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, and Elvis Presley. The Duke of Ook, as he was known, was at one time the world's oldest performing musician, and his jazzy approach to the instrument would be an influence to younger artists. He started playing professionally at the age of 8, entertaining Hawaii-based troops who were about to be launched into the European theater during the First World War. He kept it up well into the 21st century, and it's the title of his first album that we're looking for in today's quiz. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Evo Hemp, offering organic fruit and nut bars in flavors such as mango macadamia, available at club stores in Kahului, Kailua Kona, and Lihue. EVOHemp.com.
Housing. Some think it can't get built fast enough. How do we get it right as we plan for the future? Well, density done right is the focus of a talk this week by Allison Arif, who's coming in from the Bay Area to talk about best practices. She's the director of the urban planning and policy think tank SPUR. We reached out to San Francisco to chat with her about what's possible.
Well, San Francisco has a very peculiar relationship with density. We have a massive housing crisis here, as I'm sure you might have heard. We've had about 10,000 people moving to the Bay Area every year. Last year in San Francisco, for, say, 40 jobs, one unit of housing was built. So because everyone's moving here to work at Google and Facebook and companies like that, housing construction has not kept pace with demand. And there are many who think that if we just don't build anything, no one will move here. But for at least 5 to 7 years, that hasn't worked. We've had at least 10,000 people move here every year for that long and have just dug in our heels more and more and not built new housing. So we're in a situation where tons of people are getting displaced. Homelessness is terrible. There was a study out recently that fully 50% of all the new housing stock bought in the Bay Area was purchased by software engineers. So we're getting increasingly undiversified economically in our city, and we have a real problem on our hands. So we need more density, but it's a city that is actually mostly zoned for single family. And the city is really in the process of exploring whether it should get rid of single family zoning altogether.
Really?
Yeah. What happens is, you know, when you said the big house problem, the big house problem here is, you know, I live in what used to be a very modest neighborhood in San Francisco, and my house is 1,100 square feet. Typically, over the last 2 to 3 years, people will buy a house like mine, tear it down, and replace it with something 6,000 to 10,000 square feet. So that's our big house problem, including taking things zoned for two units, turning them into single-family homes instead of multifamily homes.
Okay, because those people can afford it, right? I mean, they're making fat salaries, and they can just live in a large house.
Right. Right.
Where our situation here is they build a large house and then build a lot of little bedrooms and then rent the places out as rentals
or
vacation rentals.
Sure, but our situation here is where it's illegal to build, say if you had a 10,000 square foot building, you could, I mean, in a way, I sort of prefer what's happening with you in Hawaii than here. I would rather have 10 families live in 10,000 square feet than a single man live in 10,000 square feet.
Interesting. So then the idea is about designing for density. How do you do that and do that well?
Yeah, well, there are lots of ways to do it well. I will admit 100% that there's a million ways to do it poorly. And I think in a lot of people's minds, you can only do it poorly. I mean, we have sort of a tragic history of density with, say, urban public housing projects like Cambridge Green that were built and became super dangerous and unpleasant, and they had to demolish them and clear the way for new things. We've had, just really crappy architecture where you can't tell where you are and all the buildings look the same and have no personality and, all the things that people love to complain about multifamily housing, that you can hear your neighbors and there's no place to go outside. But there's actually plenty of wonderful examples as well of density where there's really generous outdoor and shared spaces. There's like lots of great amenities like roof decks. Construction's better so that you're not hearing everything that your neighbors do. So there's ways to do it well. But I think that cities and the architecture profession haven't done a great job at coming up with good enough examples to show people that it is a viable and actually pleasant alternative to the American dream of a single family home.
Now, I know there is a project underway now where the AIA chapter here in Honolulu is working and looking at apartment zone areas just to say, hey, look, mm-hmm. here's what's possible. A lot of our housing is very old and really needs to be updated. But they're looking at that area because it is along the rail route. And, they're trying to plan and discourage monster homes from being built in residential areas because the pushback from families is, this is not the neighborhood that I knew, and we have people coming and going, and it's just changing the character of our neighborhood overnight.
Right. Well, I will say that the best way to build density is to build density on transit. A lot of people fear density because they fear they're going to lose their parking spaces. In fact, I think you could argue that people's belief in their divine right to parking is one of the biggest challenges for any urban planner or architect.
I like that. Divine right to parking.
People love their parking places. And, I've spent a lot of time in Hawaii, and I know what a big car culture it is. And that there isn't a lot of public transit. I mean, Honolulu has some, but I think the other islands, it's almost non-existent. And you shouldn't be really building too much density without the infrastructure to support it. So the best way to go about it is to think about a concept that I really love, which is called 20-minute living, which is the idea that you should be able to access all the things that you need in your daily life within 20 minutes, ideally by walking or biking or transit. So you could get to work, you could get to school, you could get to the market, you could get to a park, a restaurant, all the things without getting into a car with all these other things. Now, this is not only a convenience factor. There's also way better health outcomes. The less amount of time that you spend in the car, the better for your health. Driving a lot is associated with obesity, heart disease, depression, all kinds of terrible things, and that only increases as people's commutes grow longer. Also, climate change is real, and it's here, and dense living is actually much more environmentally beneficial than suburbs, and especially suburban sprawl. And the further people are from the centers, say job centers and other things that they need to get to on a regular basis, and the more they're driving, the more taxing that is on the environment.
But you also wrote a book, too, about prefab homes and trailers?
Two different books. Though related, I wrote a book about prefab houses and also edited a book on Airstream trailers. Prefab has always been around. When I was editor-in-chief of Dwell, the modern design and architecture magazine, I actually launched a competition to design a modern, affordable prefab home. Prefab, by the way, is homes that are built in a factory as opposed to being stick-built on-site. There's all kinds of good reasons to think about building prefab. It doesn't work for all contexts. But if you think about how a car is built in a factory and you wouldn't build a car piece by piece, one at a time, the assembly line allows sort of the efficiency of making a car. There's scenarios where you could think about building a multifamily apartment building in a factory, and you can literally deliver the entire thing in modules, completely finished with like appliances and bathrooms and all that built in. It's way more environmentally responsible to build that way. There's much less building waste. It can save a ton of time and money. Trailer parks get a bad rap. Again, there's a ton of awful trailer parks, but it's something that it's possible to do nicely and to do well. My husband and I did, he's a graphic designer. He and I have done a number of books together, and we did a book called Spa several years ago about international spas around the world. And we went to visit one in the Napa Valley, you know, some of the most expensive real estate, not just in California, but in the world. And this very, very fancy resort. And my husband said to me, I've been camping here before when I was a child. And it turned out this place had been a trailer park and was still zoned for a trailer park, but using prefab modules, they had used the same basic shapes of a trailer to create these like very high-end suites.
Wow.
At this resort.
Huh.
So you can like you could make a really nice trailer park.
What can you hold out there as good models?
So many of the good models for multifamily living are to be found not in the United States, but in, say, Europe and Japan. IKEA, believe it or not, has an amazing prefab apartment thing that they do. They've built thousands of units in Europe. They did a massive survey with homeowners to find, or for renters actually, to see what most bugged them about their apartments, and then built in ways that really addressed all of those concerns. People cited a lack of storage space, a lack of privacy, a lack of natural light, and they really put together a building that offered all of those things to tenants, and people are incredibly happy. And I visited one when I went to IKEA headquarters in Almholt, Sweden, and it was terrific. In Vienna, something like 80% of all housing is social housing. It's incredibly well designed and affordable to the majority of residents of Vienna, which is another way of looking at it, is that housing is a human right, and what's the best way that you can provide it to the most amount of people. I think the challenge in America is that we have such a different idea of what is a reasonable amount of space per person. You know, in many Asian countries, 100 square feet is luxurious, while in the United States, I wrote a piece about this for the New York Times recently, the size of the American single-family home has actually been increasing consistently, even as family size has decreased over the years. The National Association of Home Builders builds a dream home every year. The first one it built in 1966 was 1,500 square feet. At the height of the housing recession in 2006, it built one that was 15,000 square feet.
Right.
So
excess.
We really need to think about how much space we all need. Another way of thinking about it, and people who live in New York are certainly aware of this, is that you need to think about not just the space that you live inside, but what's outside your door. You know, in New York, people are willing to live in a tiny apartment because they've got this amazing, like, wonderland outside, right? Theater, museums, culture, jobs, et cetera. And so they may have a tinier space to live, but the city is their living room. And so if we are only thinking about what's available to us inside our own home, we're kind of missing the opportunity to experience so much more.
Intrigued? Want to hear more? Well, Allison Arif will give a talk at the University of Hawaii on Thursday, May 2nd at 6:30 p.m. at the University of Hawaii Architecture Auditorium.
On the next Fresh Air, Erin Lee Carr. Her new memoir is about her relationship with her late father, David Carr, a New York Times media columnist who had a large and devoted following. He was addicted to crack when she was born and got sober soon after. He was both father and mentor to Erin. She's now a documentary filmmaker. Her new film premieres on HBO Friday. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
Ships ahoy. Actually, it's more like dreams of dry dock. That's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Stuart Yurton on the line today. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, you know, I don't recall seeing a lot of stories about this dry dock this session.
There were not a lot of stories. It sort of flew under the radar. And we were looking at it for a while, and only sort of late in the session did we start seeing objections from ship repair companies who are testifying, saying, hey, doesn't look like a fair deal.
Yeah, so the concern is what? This is a special interest or special interest legislation floating around there?
That's the argument. So the idea is that the story basically goes, We have a lot of ship repairs that are done at Pearl Harbor Navy Shipyard. We have 4 dry docks there now. And the concern is those dry docks aren't sufficient to do the work that needs to be done. As a result, the fear is the Navy's going to move some ships. We're going to lose jobs. So we need a 5th dry dock.
Right. And that's always the concern, like, oh, my gosh, the business is going to go elsewhere.
Right. And it's a reasonable concern. These are good jobs. We want to keep them here. It's a lot of money and very well-paying jobs, many of them. But again, the issue is that it's being done by one company, which will own the floating dry dock and would contract with the Navy for it. And the state is really supporting this and subsidizing the development of this dry dock.
So why aren't people happy?
Well, competitors are saying, wait a minute, why are you helping this one company at Pacific Shipyards International? It's known, it's gotten sweetheart deals in the past. And people are saying, why are other ship repair companies are saying, what about us? This is not fair. We just want a level playing field.
So as far as where this is at this session, we're just about over, but has it gone anywhere?
Yeah, it's gone through. It looks like it's going to pass. I tried to talk to the senator who sponsored it, Michelle Kidani, and she didn't call me back multiple times. I've called Stanley Chang's office, the senator. He referred me to Senator Kidani, who, again, didn't call me back.
Now, I know your article talks about a special report that was done looking at the loss that our economy would really feel if our business went elsewhere.
Sure. If we did lose a lot of this business, it would be a big blow. I mean, we're talking about big ships that come here. They support a lot of jobs. Again, we're looking at the order of magnitude of contracts is something like $200 million in government contracts for ship repair in 2018 alone. We're looking at a total in the whole industry of maybe 2,500 jobs, $200 million in income. The loss is looking at something like 900 jobs, which is a lot of jobs. Now, on the other hand, when you look at the amount of money that's being steered toward this, we're talking maybe $21 million in tax credits. So it's about $23,000 per job.
So what's the Navy saying?
Well, the Navy isn't saying anything, except we do have a somewhat obscure report saying that, well, the dry docks are all in good shape until about 2030 when one of them becomes obsolete. So, something urgent. The shipyard says, we think everything's okay. We've got enough here. So, there's no word from the Navy that they're actually going to be moving these ships.
Okay, and we don't have Senator Dan Inouye around anymore to watch over us and watch out for those shipyard interests anymore.
That's right. That's a very good point.
All right. Okay, well, Stuart, well, I'll have to see what happens over the next 2 days as the session's going to wrap up on Thursday.
That's right, Catherine. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks very much. That was business reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the team at FIM Group, now part of Mercer Advisors, a wealth management firm on Maui for 22 years serving island investors, working to help families attain economic independence and succeed in their life journey.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, explorer and philosopher Erling Kagge was the first man to complete the Three Poles Challenge on foot, the North Pole, the South Pole, and the summit of Mount Everest. And he says everyone should experience the profound joys of moving through the world on your own two feet, even if it's just a trip to the corner store. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
Hawaii inmates have been in the headlines recently with the Maui riot and the fatal shooting of an escapee here on Oahu. But our next segment deals with inmates at the Saguaro Prison in Arizona, where many Hawaii convicted criminals have been sent because of a lack of bed space in the islands. We talk with film producer Kiara Lacey about the making of the film Out of State.
Prior to making Out of State, I'd never been to a prison. I actually didn't know anyone who had been to prison, really. So why make a film about this? In 2011, I got really sick. I was living in New York at the time. I'd lived in New York for about 10 years on and off. And I returned home for recovery. And while I was in physical therapy, I had an auntie, my auntie Clara Pana. She would toss out ideas. She'd be like, you should make a movie about this, or you should make a movie about that. And at the time, I didn't know if I'd be able to go back to work again. And so it was all stuff I'd like file in the back of my head, thinking, probably won't be able to do this. And one day she said, you know, there are these Native Hawaiian men who are dancing hula at this prison in Arizona, and something about all of it didn't make sense to me. And I went home, and a few weeks later I found a short clip online on YouTube, the only thing I could find, and I watched it and I cried. And something about this idea of our cultural practice behind bars, so far away from home, and the metaphor of it all, it really struck me. And, you know, as crazy as this might sound, I don't know, I just thought maybe we could heal each other. And that was 2011. It's 2019 now, so, you know, hopefully I'm doing much better, and hopefully we'll be able to, you know, help things as well for our population.
Now, this film that you created has been screened at a number of places. It's screened in the prison, I imagine?
It is screened in prisons. It has not gone back to Saguaro yet. So we're really looking forward to being able to do that. That's something we've been working with the prison to set up.
So where did it get seen, though, here?
It is now in partnership with Hawaii Council for the Humanities. It's part of a 12-part course talking about reintegration. So it piloted it last fall at Halawa Correctional Center, and is now at the Women's Center.
I can't wait till it gets screened in Arizona.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it. Really looking forward to it.
That's going to be, I think, pretty emotional.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for a lot of the men, these stories are personal. You know, it's not just seeing someone on screen. You know, we talk about authentic storytelling and showing, you know, people that look like us on screen, but, you know, these are people that they know. You know, these are people from our own community, so, and people who they've spent a lot of time with, so it becomes much more personal.
So you follow two men. We're going to be listening to a clip here. Set the stage.
Yeah, we follow two men in the film, Hale and David, and, you know, in this clip we'll hear from David as he sort of talks about his life in prison and what got him there.
You need to know your culture to know who you really are. One ounce of Hawaiian before I even came to jail. I learned everything in jail.
Wow. Now, so this, I'm sure, is about how that experience changed them. But how did it change you?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, this film really forced me to think about what I believe in. You know, I always like to think, or I think everyone likes to think, that they're open-minded or that they can have a confidence in what they believe in. But do we really get that challenged all the time in a meaningful way? And I'm somebody that believes in second chances, but how much do I really believe in that? And, you know, I'd like to believe in it for myself, but do I really believe in it for others? And this kind of pushed the test of that. And what I was reminded and what I learned through this process is we all make mistakes. And sometimes the dividing line between whether or not we're on the inside or the outside is luck. Sometimes it's money. But truly, like, there is going to be a point, you know, where you're going to need somebody's forgiveness, whether it means that you're in prison or not. And I think this film really forced me to think about that in a real way. And I believe in it.
It sounds like it's about hope that, you know, change can happen. And Hula was just part of it. I don't know, as far as keeping up with the two subjects in your film, I mean, where are they at now?
I would love to chat about that more. But we kind of like shift away from that a little bit, if only because I want people to watch all the way to the end.
Okay. And that's, let's not give it away.
Yeah, and I think that's important. Important thing to realize that, you know, in this film we're following real life, and you can't predict where real life goes. And when you look at the statistics that people face when it comes to coming into prison and returning to the community in a really healthy way, you know, the odds are stacked against you. And so, you know, I can happily say I stay in contact with the men, but it's always a challenge. The understanding and following what people go through step by step, I think that understanding is going to be really important for our community to be able to participate in.
Now, I'm just coming off of watching Patrick Mukuakani's show, Imua, at the Hawaii Theater, and there is a segment in there where he goes into San Quentin Prison and he teaches a class there. And those men are changed by what he has taught them. It's very powerful.
Yeah, and number one, I'm a fan of Patrick's work. I'm grateful for all the stuff that he's done in San Quentin. And something I can say from going to Saguaro is prison is about restriction of right. And one of the things you can't take away from somebody is who they are, who their identity is. And to go to this unlikely spot like a prison in Arizona, and with all the homesickness, with all the distance and differences from where you come from, to find a connection to who you are in this unlikely setting is incredibly powerful. And I've always used culture as a Hawaiian as my compass, and I think it gave a compass to a lot of our men. But the real question is, you know, once you find yourself changed in this setting, like, are you able to use that despite the structures and systems at hand to stay changed? You know, it's tough. It's tough when you haven't held a job for 15 years. When we were in prison, I saw some men see a cell phone for the first time. Could you imagine operating in this world today without knowing how to use email or a cell phone? I mean, that's real. It's real.
So talk about your experience as a filmmaker, knowing that you worked on this project for as long as it did, and then you know, being able to see it screened and winning awards.
You know, it's funny. I'm grateful for all of it, but truly, like, the point of it is to show that this issue is important. The awards, the places this film has shown, is to show that hopefully, number one, the work is quality, but number two, if other people recognize that this film is valuable, maybe our home and our community will too. And I'm hopeful it'll start conversations, you know, that we really need to have, because no person's an island. We live on an island, but we're not an island. And so for every individual that goes to prison from our home, they have families, they have children. And so, you know, in recognition that they're responsible for their sentences, they're responsible for what they've done, we also need to remember that they come home to people. And I am hopeful that all the awards and all the places that this film has gone to just help actually push forward that, you know, watch the film, let's have a conversation.
And so what's next for you? What's your next project, do you know?
Oh, there are so many. And that's like, that's a cool thing. There's always going to be a new thing to talk about. I am in partnership with another filmmaker. Her name is Kristen Marquez out of California. She's another Native Hawaiian, and she's rad. You'll love her. And we're working on a film called The Ninth Island. It is about Hawaiians and their connection to their home and the difficulty sometimes to afford to stay here. As the title suggests, you know, I might be spending some time in Vegas, as many Hawaiians do, and as I have as a Hawaiian. So we'll see what happens. But as you can see with Out of State, that film took a very long time to make. And, you know, we're optimistic this one will take a little bit longer, but it might be a little bit of time before I have another one to show.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us today.
Thank you.
Out of State will air on Independent Lens on PBS Hawaii May 6th. But if you can't wait, there's a special screening at the Hawaii State Museum on Wednesday, May 1st. That's tomorrow, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about Hawaii music legend Bill Tapia Aka, the Duke of Uk, who helped popularize Hawaii's signature instrument. Born to Portuguese parents, he started his professional career early. At the age of 8, he was already playing Stars and Stripes Forever for World War I troops in Hawaii. He'd go on to perform with Elvis, Bing, and Satchmo, among others. He was a jazzer, and he could coax an amazing array of sounds from his little flea. Those sounds went mostly unrecorded until 2004, when he put out his first CD entitled Tropical Swing at the age of 94, encouraging news of the It's Never Too Late variety. Ukulele virtuoso and one of Hawaii's most beloved musicians, Bill Tapi Tapia, lived to be 103. And we had no winners today. We stumped you on that one. But that's the quiz from the backyard. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On this last day of April, we tip our hat to the late W.S. Merwin, Hawaii's Poet Laureate, as April is recognized as Poetry Month. In his last book, entitled Garden Time, Merwin includes a poem entitled No Twilight. It goes like this. How sudden now it seems the day is over, and on the island where I live these late happy years of my life that Paula and I have been together, there is no twilight when the day is done. The day's shadow is gone in the moment it was here with all that went before, gone the same way into the night, where time means nothing that is visible. When I look up after the light is gone, hearing a seed fall somewhere in the dark. HBR's Noe Tanigawa interviewed Merwin a couple of times over the years, and in this conversation she had with him in 2015, she asked him about his garden in Maui and how he felt when he first saw what would become his home in Piahi.
Well, I thought, it says ruined land. It's supposed to be ruined land, and I can see that it is. I mean, the land looked like a dirt road. And I thought, I always thought, if I ever owned a piece of land, I'd like to restore it. I mean, anybody can grow roses on an English loamy, 6 feet deep garden, you know, in the perfect climate and everything. That's kind of cheating in a way. What can you do when a place is wrecked, as so many places are? And I thought, I'd like to try to restore this. And then this is part of the history of Hawaii, as a sort of fable of the history of Hawaii. I wanted to restore Hawaiian rainforest. And Ray Baker over at Lion Arboretum said, you'll never restore rainforest because So much has been lost to the conditions, to the soil and everything, and so many introduced diseases and insects and things. But it's not the way it was before they deforested it and did all those dreadful things to it. So I thought, well, let's see what will grow here then. And I took, Paula and I planted 300 coals, and they almost all died. Again and again, I found that if I put Hawaiian natives where they belong, where they've been growing 150 years ago. So sometimes they grow for a year or two, and then they were happy to die, and they just wouldn't grow here. They're tricky, you know. It's not what it was 175 years ago for them. And I was growing all the kind of palms that I could to see just what would grow here. Because I thought, you know, I can't restore native forests. I can't restore native things very well at all. But palms are endangered all over the world.
Are they?
Yeah. We know so little about them. And, you know, they've been evolving for 90 million years. They're older. They go back to the ferns. They're much older than the sequoias or anything like that. You know, even palm that we think we know all about, like a coconut, we don't know anything about the coconut. We don't know exactly when it evolved or where or how it, why it has this magnificent, wonderful, medicinally viable. I mean, there's so many things you can do with coconuts.
I open that nut, I look in there, I see the clear water, and I think, where's the life? Where's
it's
the life?
It's all life. It's all life. It's just solid life. I've always felt that I wanted to garden on poor soil. I mean, because we have to be able to grow things on not such hot conditions. And now, can we do that? So only the garden can answer me that, you know. And so this garden has been teaching me things from the very beginning. And I remember the day when I was walking up this thing and I thought, what the hell do I think I'm doing? I really don't know what I'm doing, you know.
You've done what Hokulani Holt said to do. She was talking about Haleakala. So I asked her, what do you think people could do to just get in the frame of mind to be able to understand what you're talking about, the sacredness of a place? And she said, go outside.
That's it. Yes. Stop thinking that the world is something that the human beings made, you know. It's much bigger and richer and more surprising than that. And you can keep learning from it. Will go on teaching you as long as you pay attention to it. The garden is where we settle on the earth, really, and have a different relation to it. We think that all of the questions we have are right here, and some of them are economic, and some of them are otherwise, and we forget that there's the whole night sky, which is itself nothing but questions. And,
but how do you live with not knowing?
So you have to live with not knowing. Everything of real importance in your life and in my life comes from not knowing. The arts, do you think Beethoven knew what was coming when he started the Fifth Symphony? It comes out of not knowing. So all that romantic stuff about inspiration is just recognizing something, but something where you don't know. Out of what you don't know comes.
Well, how do you go forward if you don't know?
You do. You know, how do you, Leonardo simply made another stroke on the paper. You know? The unknown is the source of every one of the arts. It's the source of our falling in love with each other. That certainly doesn't make any sense, does it? Everything, all of the known comes from the unknown. And my first book of poems, which came out in my early 20s, and I had a quotation at the beginning from a man who was actually an architect, but he was a poet. And the line was, then let us state the unknown in the norm. I thought that's so wonderful. That I want that to go with all the poetry I may ever write, you know, because that's where it comes from.
And so we close with one final poem. It's called A Present, and who doesn't like presents? It's the last poem in Werwin's last book, Garden Time. I like to think of it as a wink. Take a listen. As they were leaving the garden, one of the angels bent down to them and whispered, "I am to give you this as you are leaving the garden. I do not know what it is, what it is for, or what you will do with it. You will not be able to keep it, but you will not be able to keep anything." Yet they both reached out at once for the present, and when their hands met, they laughed. Don't you see him winking up there? W.S. Merwin, aloha and mahalo for your gift.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum, presenting the exhibition Rapa Nui, The Untold Stories of Easter Island, on display now and closing Sunday, May 5th. More information at bishopmuseum.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we hear how Spotify, an alleged disruptor of the music industry, has in some ways become the music industry.
So in a weird way, while we want to democratize music, we've kind of become gatekeepers as well.
And how valuable is Spotify really?
People always said, "Oh, Spotify is so amazing." And my response was always, "Well, it's not saving lives."
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, right after Counterspin.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, books galore. The Hawaii Book and Music Fair gets underway this weekend, and we take a look at two books in particular tomorrow. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.